This panel grows out of a book, Confronting Terror, 9/11, and the Future of American National Security. The book's title tells you its genesis and scope. Its editors, Dean Reuter and John Yoo, have followed the Federalist Society's tradition by including presentations from many points of view in the belief that the truth emerges from a contest of ideas. The book is available in both paper and electrons. I have it on my iPhone and my iPad. You can take it wherever you go. Today's panel is not quite as advertised because the cast has changed, but still presents perspectives from the book. Our first speaker will be Arthur Herman, who contributed the essay 9/11 in its historical context. He's an American historian, currently a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's known principally for his works on British history, including a bestseller on the Scottish Enlightenment, How the Scots Invented the Modern World. His most recent book, Gandhi and Churchill, The Epic Rivalry That Destroyed an Empire and Forged Our Age, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago. He's taught at Sewanee, George Mason, Georgetown, and the Catholic University. The second speaker will be Charles Kessler, who contributed the essay, Our Fighting Faith, 10 years later. He's a senior fellow of the Claremont Institute, editor of the Claremont Review of Books, and a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. He's affiliated with Claremont. He used to be the director of the Claremont McKenna's Henry Salvatore Center for the Study of Individual Freedom in the Modern World. He has written extensively on American constitutionalism from a Claremont perspective, and his edition of the Federalist Papers is the leading edition in this country. Our third speaker will be Dean Reuter, one of the book's editors. He's vice president and director of practice groups of the Federalist Society, where he's been since 2001, and as far as I know, has nothing to do with Claremont. Earlier, he was deputy attorney general and counsel to the inspector general of the Corporation for National and Community Services, and has been an attorney in private practice and at the Legal Services Corporation. The members of the panel will speak for 8 to 10 minutes each. I'll invite them to reply to each other's remarks and then turn the floor open to questions. So make notes and come up with good ones. And at the end of our 75 minutes, there'll be a quiz.
Thank you for all coming. When John asked me to contribute an essay to this volume, I realized that there were people who would be contributing on issues such as legal and constitutional questions who know far more about those questions than I do, that there would be discussion about 9/11 and the war on terror, in which those who helped to shape and formulate the policy and those who had criticized it would have a great deal to contribute. And then I felt probably the best thing that I could do would be to offer a look at the impact that 9/11 had on American foreign policy and the way in which the United States comes to view the outside world, not just in terms of the Middle East, but also in terms of its relationships with the larger global system and within the framework of American alliances and of international tensions elsewhere. And I suppose if I were to sum up the essay very briefly, what I would say is that 9/11's impact on American foreign policy would be best described as meteoric. That the immediate impact was short, intense, that proceeded to burn itself out in the streets of Iraq and in the mountains of Afghanistan, and is now settling down to a glow which is almost not even visible any longer. And in fact, under the current administration, is bades fair to fade even more. That the initial reaction tended to be one of a immediate awareness that the world is a dangerous place, that the United States has to take actions in order to limit those dangers, not only to ourselves, but also to our allies. This is not at all surprising, that when you look at it from an historical perspective, that what you see is that American history is punctuated by events not too dissimilar from that of 9/11. events like, for example, the attack at Pearl Harbor, the sinking of the USS Maine, in which Americans are suddenly, after a period of kind of complacency and apathy with regard to the outside world, suddenly become aware of the challenges and dangers that require, from an American standpoint, action and demand an engagement in the world in ways that hadn't been the case before. And that then that process of engagement then comes to an end with a different set of events, often very much arising from that engagement. Events which, like the war in Iraq, like Vietnam, like our intervention in World War I, which tends to create the opposite reaction on the part of the American public. An awareness that in many ways the United States is probably better off taking a more detached view of what takes place in the world. And that even sometimes that if we are getting ourselves involved in it, we're bound to screw things up. And therefore, the more we sort of stay away from conflicts and shrink both our engagements in the world, but also our strategic presence, the better off we're going to be, and better things will be with us. What worries me, in the case of the post-9/11 period, now 10 years later, is that we tend to see the same kind of dynamic arising now as arise in other examples, in which the swing from one of active, almost passionate engagement in the world to a kind of apathy and reaction against and withdrawal from the world, how these two things tend to often be related. That, in other words, that withdrawal from the world, that unwillingness to engage in actions and a willingness to allow multilateral bodies, for example, to take on these kinds of responsibilities, to carry forward these sorts of engagements, leaves us often vulnerable to threats from the outside. The 1930s leading to Pearl Harbor, a perfect example. The 1990s, with our sense that the Cold War was over, threats had gone away, that we could, in a sense, cruise wide, fat, and happy through the world as the sole superpower, left us blind to other kinds of threats. And now I think what we see, what worries me about our current administration, as I tried to mention in the essay, is that we tend to see a similar kind of disengagement and a kind of breaking away from possible threats that loom ahead in the future. And that we see an administration, Obama administration, which in other spheres doesn't tend to follow a laissez-faire policy, very much taking that approach towards foreign policy. Where we see with regard to China, for example, in which China being our largest credit holder, that basically what China wants, China tends to get. Even though our allies in Asia now very much concerned about the rise of China, of its strategic presence and growing militarism. That we see this with regard to the issue about Iran, where the Obama administration seems to be utterly resigned to Iran becoming a nuclear power. But for the first time, a nuclear power which sees nuclear weapons not as a deterrent, but perhaps as a first use as a strategic option. And we also see it with the current attitude, laissez-faire approach, autopilot approach with regard to the Arab Spring, where we see, for example, in the dealings with Libya, that the approach of trying to lead from behind tends to be leads to less than optimal results. And I'll give you simply one example of this in conclusion, of how this kind of regard to drop away from and move away from engagement of trying to lead to behind can lead to trouble. And this has been now with the overthrow of Gaddafi and the news that has just come just this last week about the enormous stockpiles of Russian-made, shoulder-held, surface-to-air missiles, which Gaddafi stockpiled over his years, and which have begun to disappear from warehouses in Tripoli and the other cities the rebels have taken over, as a kind of chaos has begun to spread through that area. In fact, a current member of one of the humanitarian organizations has said that in every city in which they go, you can see that's the first thing that the rebels go and seize are the SAMs and loading them up. He says, you see them loading them into cars and driving away. Well, where are they going? Where are those cars going? No one knows. There's no one on the ground to tell us and to give us an idea about what could take place with this. And it seems to me that this kind of circumstance of weapons that could be used to turn large portions of the Middle East into no-fly zones, or possibly even areas outside the Middle East into no-fly zones, ought to be a source of major concern. And the fear that I have, and I think that worries other foreign policy experts, that this kind of willingness to drift here may bring us now, 10 years after 9/11, back to the point at which we really don't ever want to go back again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge. It's a pleasure to be here. In my essay, I begin by reflecting on a short essay I posted on National Review Online the day of the attacks, in which I said that our enemies had underestimated us and that our democracy had ever been a fighting faith. And I expected very much that it would prove to be so again. And in the essay, I then proceed to examine what happened, as it were, in 10 years to our faith and to our fight. I can't reproduce everything I, of course, said in the essay, but I wanted to pick out a few strands on each of these subjects to mention here today. On the question of faith, one of the most amazing things in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 was the outpouring of religious expression in the country. The churches were full, the synagogues were full, even as President Bush noticed several times, the mosques were full. And millions of prayers rose heavenward in those days. There was a service of a national memorial service, an ecumenical one, that George Bush spoke at the National Cathedral. There was an even more ecumenical service at Yankee Stadium, presided over by our High Priestess Oprah, and Chicago's High Priestess Oprah, and Yankee Stadium is, after all, sacred ground, at least for some New Yorkers, not all. And this was this took place in a very, let's say, tolerant atmosphere for religious expression in public. Suddenly the naked public square was very richly clothed. And face to face with evil, even the ACLU blinked. There were no lawsuits filed challenging the use of public property for religious expression. There were no suits filed seeking to forbid firemen and policemen from praying in their precinct houses or firehouses or on the job. And that atmosphere lasted not quite a year, I would say, because the very next year, 2002, the lawsuit began in California over the words, "Under God," in the Pledge of Allegiance. It was alleged that having school children led in recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance, including the words "under God," amounted to an unconstitutional establishment of religion. A couple of years later, I'm glad to say the Supreme Court dismissed this suit on a technicality. And I say that because the alternative was probably for them to uphold the saying of the Pledge of Allegiance on the usual establishment grounds that the religious expression contained in it was essentially meaningless and ceremonial, and hence passed constitutional muster. The other outpouring of emotion and opinion after 9/11, which shows something about our faith, I think, was the incredible display of the American flag and the display of patriotism everywhere, in all corners of New York City, very very dramatically and noticeably, for example, but really all across the country. And in this regard, I want to say one little story. This mixture of religion and patriotism is very distinctively American, and the Pledge of Allegiance case is a typical example of flag and religion crossing paths in our country. But I chose a different story to focus on in my piece, and that is the long dance between Barack Obama and the American flag pin. A performance I call Pingate. You could summarize Barack Obama's relation to the American flag pin by saying he wore it and then he didn't wear it. Then he wore it some more and he didn't wear it. And now he wears it almost all the time. What's interesting is not so much his fluctuating attitude, but what he said about it, how he explained when asked, and he was asked repeatedly. What's interesting about this is it's a running story. It goes on for months in which he has to answer the question why he is or is not wearing an American flag pin at the time. His explanation goes through three stages, which let me characterize briefly by quoting him. The first stage is when he, on grounds of high principle, explains why he isn't going to wear the flag pin. And this is what he said. This is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in the fall of 2007. He's just announced his candidacy and is running for the presidency. Quote, "The truth is that right after 9/11, I had a pin." That is, he wore the pin immediately afterwards. "But shortly after that, particularly as we're talking about the Iraq War, that became a substitute for, I think, true patriotism, which is speaking out about the issues that are of importance to our national security. I decided I won't wear that pin on my chest." Remember that line. "I decided I won't wear that pin on my chest. Instead, I'm going to tell the American people what I believe will make this country great, and hopefully that will be a tribute to my patriotism." So that was his not his initial reaction, but his first explanation. Now, stage two of his defense of himself was to suggest that people who do wear the pin are compensating, as the Freudians say, for their inadequate patriotism. The very next day, after that quote, this is October 4th, 2007, he said the following, "After a while, you start noticing people wearing a lapel pin, but not acting very patriotic, not voting to provide veterans with resources they need, not voting to make sure that disability payments were coming out on time." In other words, true patriotism is supporting the welfare state. And those dimensions of the military that impinge on the welfare state. And then his third stage, as I have already remarked, was giving in, conceding, and essentially wearing the flag pin almost daily. What we had here really are examples of two different kinds of patriotism in America. There's the sort of middle-class patriotism that is intelligible to and appeals to firemen and policemen and middle-class Americans, in which wearing the flag pin is no big deal and is immediately intelligible as what it is, a gesture of solidarity and patriotism. Then there's the sort of patriotism, the true patriotism, as he calls it, that looks down on such unseemly displays of patriotism as ethnocentric and as preferring our country to others, as being uncosmopolitan. And that kind of patriotism appeals to professors and artists and liberal intellectuals. And Obama wanted to have it both ways. He wanted to appeal to middle class types whose votes he needed, but he didn't want to lose the respect and the cachet of the type of patriotism that appealed to his friends and liberal comrades. Towards the end of this dance, he was handed a flag pin at a Pittsburgh town hall meeting, which led to a question, from a national reporter in one of the interminable debates that characterized the campaign, the Democratic campaign season in those days. And to ABC on that day, this is in early 2008, Obama, when asked about the flag pin question, said remarkably, quote, "I have never said that I don't wear flag pins or refuse to wear flag pins," which is, as you could tell, not quite true. based on what I just quoted him as saying. But his distancing and his final capitulation are explained above all by his need to distance himself from Jeremiah Wright. Because one of the things that he had to denounce Wright for eventually, after 20 years, was that Wright had said not only that God damn America was a more appropriate sort of a saying than God bless America, but that 9/11 had been a case of our American chickens coming home to roost. That is to say, it was a case of our support of Israel coming back to bite us. And Obama had to distance himself at that point from Jeremiah Wright and had to start wearing the flag pin religiously, one might say, in order to insulate himself from that particular far-left strand of opinion about America. Now, let me say very briefly some things about the fight. That was about the faith, something about the fight. You know, a few weeks after Pearl Harbor, Winston Churchill appeared before a joint session of the United States Congress and made one of his great speeches. And in that speech, he marveled at Imperial Japan's temerity. He said, quote, "Is it possible they do not realize that we shall never cease to persevere against them until they have been taught a lesson which they and the world will never forget?" So I think the question for us to ask is, what lesson have we in our 10-year war against terror taught our enemies? And that's, I think, a difficult question to answer, and I think the answer is very sobering. In the Second World War, Pearl Harbor, as the dominating event, soon yielded to a whole stream of astonishing and grave deeds. D-Day, the discovery of the death camps, VE Day, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, VJ Day, all these things gradually supplanted the image of Pearl Harbor as sort of the key and lasting visual impression of the war. But the war against terror, as we unfortunately called it, I don't think we have had the kind of victories that have wiped out or helped to at least suppress, as it were, the memory of 9/11. I think that's still the most impressive symbol of the war against terror. All the things, all of our successes since then, the expulsion of the Taliban from Afghanistan, shock and awe in Baghdad, Saddam's fall, capture, and execution, Iraqi election days, the killing of bin Laden, have never succeeded in eclipsing, I think, the peculiar terror and lasting imagery of that day of 9/11. Now, to be sure, our enemies have learned that America is not the paper tiger that they took us for. And we've taught them a hard and bloody lesson about the consequences of attacking the American homeland. And that lesson surely gives our old enemies and our new enemies pause. I saw a bumper sticker that captured that point very nicely, which read, "Be nice to us or we will bring democracy to you." But this intimidating effect, I think, is hardly foolproof. And it sets a rather low strategic standard. Because after all, the purpose of World War II was not to make sure there was not a second Pearl Harbor, although that was certainly a part of the purpose of World War II. But the purpose of our operations was to smash our enemies, their regimes, and their capacity to wage war in any form against us. And so as much as the Bush administration and the Obama administration are to be congratulated for preventing any further mass casualty attacks on America, and they should be rightly and unhesitatingly congratulated, we ought to insist on higher standards by which to evaluate their policies as grand strategy. And there, I think, there is room for criticism and reconsideration. The way the wars unfolded, the fact that that punitive expeditions turned into occupations that would go on for 7 years in the case of Iraq and 10 years in the case of Afghanistan was never really anticipated by anyone before the hostilities broke out, and was never well understood, I think, during the fighting of the wars themselves. But the effect of these protracted occupations has been to make it virtually impossible to win these wars, to produce the kind of victories that bring a kind of psychological and intellectual and patriotic closure to them. The problem is that once you identify your purpose with the democratization of countries as difficult to democratize as Iraq and especially Afghanistan, you put your war and your definition of victory into the hands of someone else, into the hands of the populations of these foreign countries in some indeterminate future when they will have achieved a level of democracy that you are content with, or at least profess to be content with. The great costs of these wars in human terms and in financial terms has also made it difficult for us, I think, to provision our military in ways that our strategic interests in the future, for example, in regard to our coming competition with China and the issue of the nuclearization of Iran, demand from us. But it's very hard. We have had a full plate for, in terms of military affairs for 10 years, and it's very hard to think beyond that to future conflicts, which will certainly come in one form or another. So as the long war moves further and further away from 9/11, it becomes not only more difficult to sustain it, but also, I think, more difficult to explain it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. And I should say I don't speak on behalf of Claremont here today, or the Federalist Society. And did we decide that because I'm replacing two panelists that I get twice as much time to speak?
No, you get half as much time.
Exactly.
I shouldn't have asked. Well, I want to begin today by preemptively answering the question that I get asked by almost everyone I see on the streets nowadays that knows me. When they learn that I've gotten a book published, they really react with a great deal of surprise. You got a book published? And I can tell you that no one has been more surprised, even stunned, than my own dear, sweet mother. So, ever the optimist, I always try to interpret this surprise really as enthusiasm for my humble project. And then, you know, once they recover from their enthusiasm, they generally say, how did you do it? How did you get a book published? And of course, what they're really asking me is, Dean, how do I do it? How do I get a book published? And that's the question I want to answer at the outset here, because it's a quick, easy, four-step answer. First, you have to come up with a great idea that's going to be extremely popular 18 months from now, because that's about how long it takes to put one of these projects together. Second, you should try to be friends with somebody that's already published at least two or three books in this area, in the area of your general interest. In my case, that's John Yoo. Third, you shamelessly use your friend and his literary agent to get the book published. And then finally, and fourth, this is the key, you get other people to actually write the book. So the whole project's not that daunting if you can follow that four-step formula. But a little more seriously, I wanted to take this opportunity to thank John Yoo for his support of this project, his faith in this project, and his collaboration. It's been a great fun for me. I also wanted to thank all of our contributors, and especially the contributors that are here this evening. Obviously, the book wouldn't have been possible without them. And when John and I talked about this book at the outset, we did, as the judge said, we endeavored to try to have a variety of views. We wanted to cover a lot of ground, a lot of law and policy from a lot of different perspectives. We thought the value of the book would be increased with a number of different perspectives. And I'm happy to report that I think we did a good job in getting people from both sides of the aisle with lots of different perspectives. The book, in that sense, it can be read from cover to cover in one coherent swipe, or the reader can pick out a chapter here and there depending on, you know, a favorite topic or perhaps a favorite contributor. But we both thought this was a book that needed to be written, and it needed to be written in this way. So I'm happy to have it done. Now, when editing the book, the chapters tended to come in one at a time. I am definitely a right of center person, and especially when it comes to national security and defense issues. But when editing the book, I really tried to be an honest reader of the various contributors' works and to really consider what the best answers were to the many issues, legal and policy issues, that remain 10 years after the attacks of 9/11. I'm also a believer in the idea that centralized government, its first responsibility is to protect the nation and protect its citizens. But I nevertheless tried to keep an open mind as I read these so that I could get to the right answer. And it's a lesson my father taught me with a quick story that I can relate to you about getting the right answer. He once visited a restaurant. It was kind of a high-end, upscale restaurant. Sat down and asked the waiter, "What's the soup du jour?" And the waiter says, "Oh, sir, my shift just started. I don't know what the soup du jour is, but I'll go and check." Waiter retires. He comes back momentarily. He's really confident, an air of confidence, and almost triumphantly says, "It's the soup of the day." So she gets it. Thank you very much for that. But I use that as an example because not only did he not have the right answer, he really didn't even appreciate the question. So in doing this book, I really tried to get the answers right. And I wanted to try and make 3 points. I'm not sure I have time to make all 3 points. Themes that come from the book, that arise in the book, that follow through the book, the first of which I think answers the big question. And that first point I want to make, I call two presidents, one response. And you have to go back to President Bush's campaign. That's where the story starts, when in his second debate, he specifically disclaimed nation building. And it was really his intent to focus his energies and his administration on domestic matters. That was his idea for his presidency. And of course, 9/11 happened. The attacks on 9/11 happened. And by force of circumstance, he became a war on terror president. And he did so vigorously, to be sure. You fast forward 8 years, and we have President Obama, decidedly left of center president, or candidate at the time, who ran on an explicitly anti-war platform. Announced that he would close Gitmo as soon as possible, and claimed that he was against the Iraq War before it was cool to be against the Iraq War. So he was explicitly anti-war, but when he assumed the mantle of leadership, and for the first time had the weight of responsibility on his shoulders, for the first time was responsible for the safety of the country and its citizens, and for the first time had access to all the information and all the intelligence that's uniquely available to the President of the United States, he by and large, with some important exceptions, came to the same policy conclusions that President Bush had. This became clear to me in reading these various essays. There's a lot of unanimity on that point. And I think in doing so, President Obama very powerfully validated the policies, the war on terror policies, of his predecessor, President Bush, with two such divergent presidents coming to largely the same conclusions. I think they tend to validate each other, in fact. That's the first point I wanted to make, two presidents, one response. The second point I want to make is kind of a larger, bigger picture constitutional question, and I think of this in terms of don't blame the executive. In addition to being a kind of right of center person when it comes to national security, I'm one of these folks who likes to think that the great genius of the Constitution lies in its structure. And I think the founders, you know, were students of government, students of human nature, recognized the predilections of man for power, recognized the way governments operated, the accumulation of power. They feared accumulation of too much power in any one individual or any one institution. And consequently, they divided power in the federal government as best they could. In Federalist 51, it says, ambition must be made to check ambition. And in my vision, in my view of the constitutional structure, this means that each branch of government must fully exert its powers. It must exercise its powers completely. And if it fails to do so, it doesn't go to the limits of its power, it will create a vacuum, and the other branches of government, by their nature, will fill that vacuum by encroaching. So the way the government works, the way the balance is stricken, there's a requirement, essentially, that every branch exert its powers robustly. So I think if you fall into the camp that believes that the executive has overstepped, that the executive has overreached, I'm not in that camp, but if you're in that camp, your complaint might not be with the executive itself, but it might be with another branch of government. Because I don't think it's the responsibility of the executive branch to construe its powers modestly or narrowly. So that's the second point I wanted to make. The third and final point I wanted to make in Bob Barr's absence is kind of a tip of the hat to the civil libertarians that whose works appeared in the book. I wanted to kind of outline very briefly two things that give me pause where I have the most sympathy for and libertarian sympathies. And that's two characteristics of the war. One is the geographical scope of the war. I think, you know, President Bush, to take one step back, President Bush, I think, did us a great favor when he decided to respond to the attacks as an act of war. It opened up to us a treasure trove of tools that can be used in wartime that can't be used in a criminal law enforcement capacity. So when he saw this as an act of war, we had all those tools available to us. In addition to waging war, tools that included surveillance, interrogation, apprehension, detention, things that you can't do in a criminal law enforcement regime. That having been said, most observers believe that the battlefield is virtually worldwide. And I have sympathy with civil libertarians who see a worldwide battlefield, and if those rules of war follow the battlefield, if those tools of war follow the battlefield, that's some cause for concern. I think there's some real concern there. The other characteristic of the war that I think concerns a lot of civil libertarians is the duration of the war. How do we know when this war is going to end? How long are these war tools available to the executive? There doesn't seem to be an end in sight. Is the war over when Osama bin Laden is killed? Apparently not. Is the war over after a certain number of years without a subsequent attack by al-Qaeda? Is the war over when their membership numbers, you know, fall below a certain level? And maybe even as importantly, who gets to decide when the war is over? So I think those couple of characteristics about the war on terror, that's where my sympathies, you know, come most in line with civil libertarians. And I think I'll just stop there and look forward to the discussion and the questions from the audience.
Thank you. Now, do the members of the panel have any comments on what the other members have said?
Not at this.
No. They seem to have summarized themselves very well.
I could have, if you want one.
Sure.
Well, Dean, where are you on the question of the declaration of war question? That not going to Congress for some kind of a declaration puts us in a legal limbo in terms of
for
executive power and other things.
In the war on terror?
Yes.
I think the authorization for the use of military force provides all the authority needed. I don't have any doubt about that. I think there have been 5 declared wars in the history of the country.
Right.
I don't think that's a real concern or a real issue. Might have a different answer on Libya, but with regard to the war on terror, I think that's pretty clear-cut, pretty straightforward.
I, of course, don't even know what it means. I understand perfectly what it means to declare war on Japan. I'm not sure what it would mean for Congress to declare war on terror.
Yes, that was one of the complications, obviously. Yeah, it would be very messy upon whom one was declaring this war. Yeah.
Since it's not, by and large, an organized state.
Right, but the authorization for use of military force, which is the closest thing we have to that, is written quite broadly. It includes al-Qaeda, its supporters, its affiliates. It's a pretty broad license to the president.
Right. Well, we have 30 minutes for questions, but I'll exercise the prerogative of the chair and ask two. There was a brief discussion of Libya, for example, and I'm not at all enthusiastic about the prospect of waking up one morning and discovering that a plane has been shot down taking off from O'Hare because of missiles that were seized in Libya.
I don't think anybody is.
Right. Question is, what implications does that concern have for actual behavior? I mean, everyone agrees that the people who might be engaged in terrorism are distributed throughout the world. Everybody agrees, I think, that the United States is not planning anytime soon to invade and occupy the entire rest of the world in order to catch those people through the operation of the police forces. So what realistic options are there?
Well, I think in that regard, the way in which you pursue foreign policy has always been in terms of nation states and relationships with nation states, as opposed to pursuing a sort of a vague questions like militant Islam or even Al-Qaeda terrorist networks. These aren't the kinds of proper spheres by which a country such as the United States, although it has interest in defeating such forces, that the proper levers by which one deals with them is through the nation states that enable those networks and those kinds of ideologies to spread and to be put into motion.
Of course, Libya is a very difficult case. For a long time, the United States dealt with Libya as a state sponsor of terrorism, which, of course, it was. There was then a period of rapprochement where we declared that Gaddafi had been cured or something like that, and we were trying to deal with Libya by embracing it and using some economic incentives. And then when there's a domestic uprising in Libya, we switched sides again and asked for and engaged in military action to help remove Gaddafi as the head of the country. But of course, that last step entailed a very substantial degree of domestic chaos. All civil wars entail a great degree of domestic chaos.
But it's interesting.
Were there different things that might have been taken to avoid where we are now?
Well, I think on the one hand, you could say it's three contradictory policies, but I think there are also three quite different phases based upon the view of the world. Don't forget the state sponsor of terrorism. One was the kind of robust interventionist kinds of policies that, for example, that Reagan had used. We're not going to say invade you, but you lay a glove on us and we'll lay a fist on you. The Bush change, which, of course, the change, the cure, we have to remember, ironically, was one of the unexpected benefits of having toppled Saddam Hussein, which was that Gaddafi suddenly got the idea that, well, I just might be next in line. And so I think it's time for me to sort of turn in my weapons of mass destruction programs. And as a result, he was promoted to most improved boy in the class and was given this sort of, as you say, this kind of reception here, of which he was not the only one, by the way. That kind of approach to dictators has been a part of American policy with regard to Syria. It was part of the policy towards Saddam himself at a period of time. Now, the third one is the one I think that's been the most troubling, which is to really basically have no real policy at all, which is that it was very clear that on the one hand, there was strong reasons of national interest to remove Gaddafi once and for all. For one thing, he was still very much connected with terrorist networks. There was no doubt about that. No one really knew what was happening with his weapons of mass destruction programs. There was every reason to take this advantage of the situation and to use it to U.S. advantage. But that was precisely the policy that Obama decided not to pursue. That in his desire not to be George W. Bush, he was in fact willing to basically allow the whole Libyan operation to proceed on autopilot. And I mean that in almost in a literal sense, where we provided most of the ordnance, most of the military muscle for the operation, but the basic guidance and goals were set by NATO countries, particularly France and Great Britain. And the basic tempo of the fighting and the direction of it were left to a group of rebels about which we knew very, very little and with whom our relations only really took place months after it became clear who was going to win this conflict. So we had no guidance in sort of what their agenda was going to be, what the ground game was going to look like once they had, in fact, toppled Gaddafi, if they were going to do so. And what the future was going to look like. That's where the real failure, I think, has come in and where the issue is about. If we had been engaged from the beginning here, or alternately had sort of say, we're going to have nothing to do with it, Gaddafi's going to stay in place because we'd much prefer him to a Al-Qaeda-dominated government, then this situation would not have arisen. This is precisely what happens when you decide that it's better for the United States not to get involved in these things, but to simply watch on the sidelines and hope it comes out okay. And that seems to be where we're headed in this direction. And it's not surprising when you realize how much Obama himself was shaped by that other period, the post-Vietnam period of withdrawal from the world, in which the idea was, unlike the isolationists of the 1930s who believed that the United States was too good to engage in dealings with the outside world, in which the view of the 1970s after Vietnam for many on the left was the United States was too wicked to engage in the world on the outside. That's part of Obama's background. That's part of his view about American foreign policy. What worries me is that when that kind of withdrawal and passive attitude is allowed to follow its full course, and we suddenly confront a situation like a shoot down from over O'Hare Airport or Kennedy Airport, that again the reaction will be one which will become very drastic and will make the post 9/11 reaction look like something that Bob Barr might endorse.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to come back now to your observation that there's a very large difference between the war on terror and, say, World War II. World War II was characterized by particular milestones. There were battles won, countries occupied, bombs exploded. Success, if there is any success in the war on terror, is characterized by what didn't happen. Another year has gone by without any repeat of 9/11 in the United States. It's now a decade has gone by without anything remotely similar, or even an attack on subways in the United States. That makes it very difficult to define victory. And one, this is a kind of war that one couldn't possibly win by ensuring that there are no nasty dictators anywhere in the world. There's no policy that can be pursued that will get rid of every analog of Libya and Syria and North Korea and so on. Is it then impossible to define success? And if it's impossible to define success when you're having a war where victory means nothing is happening, should one try to redefine the ends, the goals?
Yes, but I think the meaning of the Bush Doctrine as finally expressed in the second inaugural, it points precisely to the impossible definition of victory mm-hmm. that you've just mentioned. That is, the end of tyranny on earth is the explicit goal of the Bush Doctrine of American foreign policy as he described it in the second inaugural. That is, I think, a utopian goal.
It's a utopian goal, and it's defined in such a way that it cannot possibly be achieved, and therefore we've already lost that.
That's
war.
Right, and it's not good to wage war in pursuit of an impossible dream.
Right.
And therefore, some kind of prudential redefinition of the purpose of the war, I think, is very necessary. And if it doesn't happen prospectively and thoughtfully, it will happen de facto. I mean, mm-hmm. at some point, when the last U.S. soldier leaves Afghanistan or leaves Iraq, the war will be over, or effectively. I mean, the counterintelligence will continue and so forth and so on. But for all intents and purposes, politically, the war will be over.
Will that mean the color code will finally change?
It will go to plaid.
All right, we are open for questions on the floor. The Federalist Society tradition requires two things. One, you should identify who you are. And second, even if your question entails a declaration of some kind, it should at least end with an upturn of the voice implying that an answer is being solicited.
My question is about religious nature of the war on terror, if it's a war on radical Islam or if it's a war on terror. After the Cold War, we engaged not only militarily but also in the arena of ideas with Radio Free Europe and believing in America's rightness and the fact that American way of life is worth defending and worth giving to other people. I don't see the same level of engagement in the arena of ideas against radical Islam and their belief systems. And I guess my question is that happening? Are we addressing how our belief systems are superior to theirs? And if we're not,
Why not?
I'll take that. I don't think we are, certainly not in a full-throated way, and I think we're not because of the religious implications of that and religious freedom implications of that. There are a couple chapters in the book that I think deal with this head-on and deal with the ideology of the enemy. Ted Olson, we decided we'd open the book with the chapter by Ted Olson, former Solicitor General of the United States, who lost his wife. His wife was murdered. She was aboard the American Airlines flight that was flown into the Pentagon on 9/11. And he wrote this speech just weeks after 9/11. And he speaks very powerfully about the nature of the enemy and the fact that they attacked America because we're Americans. And he refers to Islam, their use of Islam as a mask. And you know, he doesn't think that at least that time, didn't think that the attackers are true representatives of Islam. Of course, they are radicalized. Andy McCarthy, on the other hand, I think is leading who's also a contributor to the book, is now, I think, beginning to lead the discussion about Islam and how fundamentally incompatible, radicalized Islam especially, is with Western notions of democracy. So I think we haven't addressed it in a full-throated way. I think we're only beginning to look at it. But really, it's just the commentators who are beginning to look at it. I don't think the government has you know, in any public way, begun to examine those questions. There have been a couple hearings on Capitol Hill that were widely publicized and widely criticized because they started to ask some of those difficult questions. But you know, when those hearings were announced, those questions, even asking those questions, was looked at as at least impolite.
I think there's been, even within the Bush administration, there has been, leaving Obama aside for the moment, there was some confusion about this question. On the one hand, a powerful and prominent line of analysis from Bush was that on 9/11 we had seen the face of evil, and that what we faced was a kind of, the hijackers were trying the terrorists were trying to hijack their own religion, their own peaceful religion, as he put it, and turn it into a totalitarian ideology. That would, if that's true, then that would logically lead to some kind of Cold War-like battle of ideas of the sort you're talking about through public diplomacy and other aspects. At the same time, at other moments, Bush made a very different argument, which was that the lack of democracy in the Middle East was the cause of terrorism. That is, that they grew up in societies that repressed their own people, and that repression had to be discharged in some way, and the regime encouraged them to discharge it against the West rather than against the regimes, the non-democratic regimes themselves in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East. The second line of argument suggests that it is, in a way, it does not exonerate the terrorists, but it explains them. It attributes what they did not to evil or to a love of tyranny or to a, you know, a perverted love of honor or pleasure or power, but to a bad upbringing. And it was up to us to correct the bad sociology of those countries. So that, as Bush once put it, if they had grown up in countries where you could protest around the clock, they would be much less inclined to blow themselves up during rush hour. And that suggests that nothing less than a wholesale transformation of the world can save it. And that the ideological battle becomes a very different kind of battle. It's not us versus them, or our principles versus their principles exactly. It's rather our principles versus their bad history, conditions, and things that can be easily, if not quickly, remedied.
There's also a foreign policy complication here that also makes the discussion that you're talking about made it difficult and may still make it difficult, but certainly in the post 9/11 environment. And that is that two of our closest allies in the immediate post 9/11 period were countries in which
would not have tolerated in a kind of an attack on what we would call Islamic fundamentalism, namely Saudi Arabia, and the other one was Pakistan. We forget about the role, the problems that Musharraf had, General Musharraf had as in Pakistan, with trying to close down the madrasas, which were, of course, a major fomenters of Islamic fundamentalist ideas. But this was a process in which he faced enormous internal pressures, resisting attempts to close those kinds of things down. And the more a Bush administration would have openly pushed a kind of strong pro-Western, you know, the superiority of Western kinds of ideas, this could have complicated our dealings with those two countries as well under those circumstances. And neither the State Department nor the administration was going to go that kind of way. Hence the importance of maintaining that distinction between the terrorists on the one hand and Islam on the other. We had allies on the line with us on precisely that distinction, rightly or wrongly.
Part of this discussion points out a regularity that's been noticed by the political scientists and economists, which is that stable democracies just don't attack each other. The combination both of the internal democracy and of the trade relations that come out of democracy to make it not worthwhile to attack one another. But it is then very difficult to see how one creates stable democracies. You can create democracies. Think about Pakistan. Pakistan is officially a democracy, but it's had so many coups that it's very difficult to know what that has meant. It's been a very fragile democracy. One of the characteristics of a stable democracy has been, for example, relatively high levels of education. But the United States can't just decree that relatively high levels of education be achieved and maintained. And this, of course, is one big difference between this war and the Cold War, which ended with most of Europe, most of Eastern Europe at least, turning into stable democracies. Which are now our allies and not a source of major concern. Now members of NATO joining the European Union. I mean, even places that were extraordinarily disordered, like Romania, are now successful functioning democracies. But it wasn't really because of anything the United States did, but because they'd achieved good levels of education and they much preferred democracy to authoritarian government. Not clear how we bring that about in.
And those are cases, or most of those are cases of captive nations, where you, I mean,
well,
you
Romania
had a...
had not had a functioning democracy earlier.
No, but you had, they were anti-Soviet Union because they had been satellized by the Soviet Union, and that put them almost, you know, necessarily on our side in the Cold War, and as such gave democracy a cachet that it doesn't have in Iraq, or Afghanistan, or other countries in the Middle East.
And countries which were, certainly prior to World War II, much more part of the West.
Right. And much more
prosperous. Intellectually and culturally. Than
that was certainly true of Hungary and Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, well, that's right.
More questions? It's hard for me to see, so you'll just have to pass the microphone out. It's very bright here and dark there, so my vision is limited.
Thank you. My name is Barra McLean, and I'm an attorney. My question is, and I'll be pretty blunt about it, I've listened very carefully to all the remarks and found them very informative, but can any of you really state a strong support for this vision of winning the hearts and minds, which, as far as I'm able to tell, as an avid reader on this subject, and conversationalists on this subject, Afghanistan and Pakistan have largely been disastrous relationships.
I have an indirect response to that, and I don't know about winning hearts and minds in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq. What disturbs me about some of the discussions that we get into when we head that down that road are the undercurrents that you know, this all began because of something America has done. And that's an argument I hear from a lot of people, that it's the lack of attention we've given to the rest of the world, or it's the imperial intention we've given to the rest of the world that had caused these reactions from people. I don't buy that argument. I'm not saying you're saying that. But that's disturbing to hear that. And I think sometimes when we take on the responsibility for spreading democracy, in a way it almost bolsters that argument. That's my indirect response to your question.
Your question made me think of something that Deng Xiaoping said to Henry Kissinger when they met in Beijing in the 70s, and Kissinger asked him, he said, well, what do you think now, you as an old revolutionary, what is the significance of the French Revolution in history? And Deng Xiaoping said, oh, it's far too early to tell. And I think that's maybe far too early to tell just how our policy in Afghanistan is still going to play out, and even in Pakistan as well. It's difficult to sort of say what the final results will be. I would say the thing about the struggle for the hearts and minds is that to a certain extent the United States may have no choice. In other words, the numbers of times that we've sort of given up on the hearts and minds, something even worse has happened. This is my basic point, that when you sort of give up on that kind of, not the issue of spreading democracy, but the idea that fostering and supporting regimes that at least approximate that kind of ideal is an important imperative to us, is one that has enormous implications if you give that kind of thing up and sort of say, let's just bring the troops home and let's have done with it. These things have ways of boomeranging back. The real question is, how do you devise the kinds of strategies that allow these situations then to not get worse and possibly see some kind of progress in the future? I think we may see that with Afghanistan, and it may be with a different administration, with a different set of objectives. We may see that in the future with Pakistan mm-hmm. as well.
You honestly think that these two regimes, meaning Afghanistan and Pakistan, putting Iran to the side, approximate our government? I'm talking about
general terms. In these two particular cases, and you've chosen two very difficult cases, there's no doubt about it. But I don't really quite see how the situation is improved by the U.S. disengaging. That's my whole point. I mean, think about this for a second, again, from a historical perspective. Three times in history, the United States has brought home its troops after major conflicts. Three times, modern history, right? First time was after the Civil War, Reconstruction. 1877, American troops, federal troops came home out of the southern states. By the way, as a result of a public, American public, which was very discouraged by the insurgency that was being conducted by a group called Ku Klux Klan, and the feeling that it was just not worth it, we have no reason to keep our troops down there, the situation is hopeless. Well, look at the result. The result was the rise of Jim Crow, segregation, lynchings, and of course the South falling into an economic malaise for about 70 years as a result. The second time was after World War I, when the last American troops came home in 1923. People forget about this. We occupied Germany, large portions of Western Germany, up until 1923, when again the decision was made, forget about it, the European powers will never straighten them out. It's a hopeless squabble. They're a hateful bunch of people. Let's leave them to their own fate. Well, by doing so, what the United States did was to basically renounce any kind of role in collective security for Europe. Played a major role in convincing, in the spread of dictatorships, of undermining the morale of democracies there. And of course, having withdrawn our troops from Europe in 1923, 20 years later, they go back in, this time landing at Anzio and at Salerno and then at D-Day as well, to straighten out the mess that had been left behind. And then, of course, the third time's in Vietnam, where the same kind of, where the very phrase of hearts and minds comes from, where again, we simply had decided this is a hopeless situation, there's nothing that can be done. And even though we had won the war on the battlefield, the decision was made to bring home the troops here and to basically abandon Indochina to its fate. And the result was, of course, genocide in Indochina, but also a resurgent Soviet Union that required then the Reagan administration build up after that.
So you have to be very careful when you wish to bring your troops home. Very careful. When we contrast that with the experience in Western Europe and South Korea, for example, and then in Japan, we can see a different sort of situation playing out. I understand the impatience with it, but I think we have to be very careful not to make the historical judgments snap ones. Not that you're trying to do that, of course.
Yeah, I don't think it's snap time. I think we'll go past snap time. Yeah.
Other questions?
Yes, my name is Ben Walden. I'm a law student. I had a question about the domestic situation with regard to the power vacuum and bringing back into balance sort of the executive power relative to the legislative and judicial branches, and how you felt that would come about. What's needed to bring that back into line if you feel that the executive power has expanded during this period?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that question because it gave me a chance to clarify that. I don't think the executive has overstepped. I don't think the executive has overreached. I do think executive power, by its definition, it would expand during wartime. But my point was that if you're in the camp that thinks the executive has overstepped, then I think your complaint really lies with another branch of government, not with the executive, because it is the executive's duty to assert its power aggressively. And it's the duty of the other branches to push back. That's the natural give and take. So I hope that answers your question.
Though I worried a little when Dean earlier said every branch should assert its powers to the fullest extent. I had this picture of him wanting the Supreme Court to order the president to pay damages for making incorrect military decisions and otherwise beginning to behave more like the Ninth Circuit. Cause of some concern, but I'm sure that's not what he meant.
Thank you again for clarifying that.
One final question. We're supposed to end at 5:45. We started a few minutes late, so we can run a few minutes late, I understand, but this may be it. So,
hi, guys. My name is Heather. I'm a cook downtown, and I was just wondering, I have a brother who did 3 tours in Iraq, and he's permanently damaged from it. So when you say that they should stay, I wonder why you think that is better or worse, and what makes you think that American troops are going to influence democracy in a country that doesn't want it?
Well, I'm very sorry about your brother, obviously. Obviously there's lots of lives that were destroyed by experience in Iraq, both American and also Iraqi. And also there were a lot of lives that were spared as a result of American intervention in Iraq as well, and of a change that's taken place in that country, which I think, in general, can be presented as being an overall positive one, certainly compared to the regime that Saddam Hussein maintained in that period through that period. I think that the idea that you can, in a sense, improve the situation in a country like Iraq or Afghanistan by pulling American troops out and letting the people involved sort of figure it out for themselves what they're going to be doing after American intervention of the kind that we had, rightly or wrongly, I think would be a tragic mistake. Again, it's the kind of situation which tends to boomerang back to America in those kinds of situations where that decision is made. I just mentioned several of them, both Vietnam, World War I, and then, of course, I bring in the example of Reconstruction because I think it was a classic example in which progress was made in terms of the reintegration of freed slaves into society. Enormous strides were made under the withdrawal of federal troops under the kind of political pressures that were involved was, in fact, one could argue, one of the great catastrophes in American history. The American South and Iraq, the post-Civil War South and Iraq, in fact, have a lot of parallels, more perhaps than you realize. And I think that the American presence and continuing American engagement in Iraq is one that does provide for a better future for both countries, and that the idea that Iraq, without an American presence, won't fall under the orbit of Iran, and may not even which may even foment again the kind of sectarian violence that we had before, I think would be I think an exercise in self-delusion.
Well, I think I don't quite agree with you about this. It seems to me that the first rule of foreign policy is you have to deal with foreigners. And foreigners are, by definition, not people like us. It seems to me that after a 10-year experiment, the wisdom of pursuing the same policy indefinitely is very suspect to me. It's unclear. It is hard. Once you've been there for 10 years, it becomes a slightly different situation than it was going in as to whether what you're going to do and how long you're going to do it. There are all sorts of second best and third best solutions that have to be considered once you've been there for 10 years, because I agree, having been there and done what we have done for 10 years, it is very hard simply to disengage. But it does seem to me that Iraq if it is to be a democratic society, it's not going to be a liberal democratic society. I mean, one thing we have to keep in mind in these discussions is it's fairly easy to institute regimes of elections. I mean, Iran has regimes of elections. If that's your definition of democracy, then you can, I mean, many Islamic societies are and many Arab Islamic societies are prepared to accept that instrumentally. But if you're talking about liberal democracies in which there is respect for human rights and religious tolerance and all that we would seek and all that we mean when we speak of democracy, I think the chances of Iraq becoming that kind of society are very, very small. And Afghanistan virtually non-existent. It seems to me that, therefore, our policy has to be reconsidered in light of the realities on the ground. What that means precisely, what do we do, how many troops do we leave, for how long, I don't know. But just in terms of principle, I'm very sympathetic to your...
it's not just me, it's thousands of people across the country.
Yes, but that's, it seems to me that the problem is the alternatives are not democratization along the lines that Arthur is talking about, or isolationism. There's a whole set of policies in between those things, which are have been. Walter Russell Mead calls them Jacksonian foreign policy, but in many ways it's a very traditional American foreign policy to go back and forth between principles and prudence. There are other alternatives than simply being indifferent to the world and withdrawing into the homeland and trying to democratize.
I would think you have a much stronger case if you were to bring up Afghanistan, because the way forward there is much less clear than it is in Iraq. I mean, Iraq has turned out to be, at this point, pretty much of a success, if the point of view of giving a stable government with some form of pluralist political systems. That's why I don't find the comparison with Iran very. I mean, these are elections that are much more meaningful. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, too, it's the one major Middle Eastern country which has sort of avoided the great turmoil of the Arab Spring, in a sense because they've already gone through it, but also because you have a government which is much more reflective of broader public opinion of the various groups that constitute Iraqi society today. But I think in the case of Afghanistan, there the challenge, I think, of finding your way forward, groping your way forward, is much more difficult and much murkier.
Well, thank you very much. I think it is time to declare victory and thank the panel for their contributions.